In the Studio is sponsored by AT&T and by Trident Sugarless Gum.
Doc, you didn't have the cat jam left hand. You didn't like the way your hand was.
Excuse me, is this thing on?
Whoa.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
You're welcome.
Guitar up.
One,
turn
two,
that guitar
three.
Up.
Hi, and welcome to In the Studio. I'm Redbeard, bringing you the stories behind the greatest rock and roll albums in history. Today we'll go in the studio for part one of a two-part tribute to the first rock opera.
Rock and roll is about the moment that you become alone, the moment when you grow up, the moment when you leave home, or the moment when you... The reference I always give now, currently, is that East of Eden moment where Jimmy Dean is facing his dad across the room and he's about to leave and it's all in his face. He can't speak. It's like a great kind of My Generation stuttering moment. He can't say what he wants to say. But interestingly enough, neither can his father. His father can spill out invective, call his son a creep, tell him he's got to get a job, you know. And then there's this thing with the mother, you know, who wants everything to be right. That moment is what rock and roll is. Whether you stay or whether you go, you are from that moment alone. You will never, ever not be alone again. And that's what rock and roll is about. Hi, this is Pete Townsend in the studio for the making of The Who's Tommy Part 1.
Although rock and roll was more or less still considered to be an unruly child in the late 60s, the ever-expanding audience for this musical counterculture already thought it had seen it all by 1969. There was the phenomenon of the Beatles, including their studio masterpiece, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Jimi Hendrix had come along to redefine the boundaries of guitar playing. Jim Morrison and the Doors challenged Ed Sullivan in Middle America by singing Couldn't Get Much Higher, right there on live television. And let's not forget the notoriety of the Rolling Stones in 1969. But in the first half of that year, along came The Who's Tommy, an album that pushed and pulled the music of a new generation into an arena that was untested and certainly uncharted, the rock opera. Since then, Tommy has also become a film, and now a successful Broadway production. Until Tommy, The Who were basically known as a singles band. They had scored 8 consecutive top 10 hits in their native England with songs like I Can't Explain, Substitute, and My Generation. Only one of their first 3 albums did particularly well, but it was on their second record that Pete Townsend of The Who initially flirted with the concept of a mini-opera on the track A Quick One While He's Away. Townsend had been encouraged by then-manager Kit Lambert to write more thematic pieces. What led to the decision for The Who to attempt a whole album based on one thematic idea came in 1967, following the release of I Can See for Miles. Although it became the biggest hit for The Who in the U.S., it didn't do quite as well for them in the U.K., which was especially disappointing for Pete Townsend, who had thought that song was going to be his worldwide number one hit. Here's Pete Townsend.
I went to Kit Lambert. I said, listen, I'm never, ever, ever going to be able to top this song. I can never write a better song than I Can See for Miles. What am I going to do? What are we going to do? And I don't know whose idea it was. I don't know whether it was Kit's, I've forgotten now, or mine, or whether it came out in conversation or whatever, but we decided to do an opera. And it was a kind of a, you know, it felt not only a dangerous thing to do, but it did actually feel like a, you know, an exception to the rule. I actually felt that I was stepping outside my job. I was abandoning my rock and roll legion. You know, I was leaving my boys behind and writing this thing, which was actually very much trying to address what had happened around me in the late 60s, which was a drug revolution, a psychedelic drug revolution, which was producing something that people called, you know, peace and love. You know, I'm so cynical about this stuff. I'm so cynical about it. I saw it from various different sides, and I had some nice times. But you know, so to some extent, it was a desperate, desperate act, and to some extent, a cynical act. You know, a confused act, You know, I didn't really know what I was doing, and I didn't really know it was going to work, you know.
The Overture from Tommy, which was recorded in an era when most rock albums were made in just a couple of weeks, at most a month or two. But this project was a double album that had many parts to it. So I asked Pete Townshend how long it took to record Tommy.
About 3 months. But I mean, we weren't working all the time. It was just 3 months a period, you know, a period of 3 months. Because then I would go back and I would work in my studio. It felt like recording for 3 months to me because I would actually be producing 8-track demos at home. Two-track demos. I was still working machine-to-machine in stereo. It was solid work. It was expensive because we were in the studio a long time, but we weren't wasting time. It was actually just, it was a lot of work, you know. It's a lot. If you listen to it, it seems quite simple, but there was a lot of work in there, and it's like, we also recorded lots and lots and lots of tracks that aren't on the records, which certainly I've got demos of songs that were intended for the album. I think one that immediately leaps to mind is a song called Kevin's a Model Child. And there were others. There was a song, in a sense, you know, some of the things that have happened in Tommy's later incarnations in the film and in the show, where I've written new songs to serve particular functions that have been required to help tell the story better, I already had anticipated then, and there are songs that were supposed to serve those functions. But really, when we put the album together, we realised that the story shouldn't be too complete. For rock and roll, there should be mystery in it and loose ends. And
well, I know I found some mystery in the story when I first heard the album as a 16-year-old. I got tripped up very early in the storyline by the next song called 1921. It seems that a very key event happens at this time in the rock opera Tommy, but I didn't figure it out just by listening to the lyrics of the song. For years, I thought Tommy was born deaf, dumb, and blind.
No, there's a traumatic experience. He witnesses his father, who he's never met, returning and finding his mother with a lover, and witnesses the father shoot the lover, this lover who is, for all intents and purposes, Tommy's father. This stranger walks in, shoots his father, his stepfather or his surrogate father, and then claims to be his father and claims his mother, and that moment is bad enough. Except that then what happens is that the parents, in desperation at this terrible, you know, accident, if you want to call it that, are afraid that the boy will give them away, that there might be some chance that they can say that the lover produced a gun or produced a knife or something, and that it was self-defense. And they rage at the child. They turn on the child in the heat of the moment, and they say, well, you won't say anything, will you? You'll keep our secret. You'll keep quiet. You'll keep quiet. You'll keep quiet. And the child's response is to be thrown into a deep trauma.
Got a feeling 21 is gonna be a good year, especially if you and me.
I'm Red Beard, and we'll hear more about The Boy with Pete Townshend in the studio for The Who's Tommy, Part 1.
Hello, this is Pete Townshend in the studio for the 25th anniversary of The Who's Tommy.
And I'm Red Beard, thanking you for joining us on this special two-parter. There are so many different elements that make up the story to Tommy, from long instrumental passages to power chord rock and roll to stage-like dialogue that keeps the story moving. I asked Pete Townshend if there was one song or moment in the story that kind of tied all the bits together.
I think it was Amazing Journey. I think Amazing Journey was the song, and is the song that in a sense tells the story of Tommy in a kind of synopsis. You know, deaf, dumb and blind boy, he's in a strange vibration land. You know, strange as it seems, his musical dreams ain't quite so bad. You know, that's it, really. And that was the first song that I wrote, the very first.
The dumb and blind boy, he's in a quiet vibration land.
As Tommy's amazing journey gets rolling, he's confronted by the Hawker, a pimp who wishes Tommy could see his woman, the one with that special magic that, quote, brings eyesight to the blind. But it's at this point that Tommy is very much alone and isolated. Physically, he's still a part of his family, but he can no longer express his feelings or desires to anyone. Ironically, Pete Townsend believes this to be the essence of what rock and roll is all about.
Rock and roll is about the moment that you become alone, the moment when you grow up, the moment when you leave home, or the moment when you... The reference I always give now, currently, is that East of Eden moment where Jimmy Dean is facing his dad across the room and he's about to leave and it's all in his face. He can't speak. It's like a great kind of My Generation stuttering moment. He can't say what he wants to say. But interestingly enough, neither can his father. His father can spill out invective, call his son a creep, tell him he's got to get a job, you know. And then there's this thing with the mother, you know, who wants everything to be right. That moment is what rock and roll is about. Whether you stay or whether you go, you are from that moment alone. You have no protection anymore. Your family haven't disowned you, and you haven't disowned your family. You might still have a relationship, but from then on, you are an adult. You will never, ever not be alone again. And that's what rock and roll is about. Rock and roll is about that moment. And that moment, actually, I think, tends to happen to most boys at around 16 or 17, and for some girls, as early as 12 or 13. One of the things that I find deeply satisfying about it is that it actually explains to me a lot of the effectiveness of Tommy within the rock genre. You know, I thought Tommy was going to exist outside rock and roll, but it was so readily welcomed into rock and roll as a rock and roll piece. And I could never quite work out why. And I think it's because it itself is a part of that definition. It is actually, rather than being a metaphor for, you know, the Tommy being deaf, dumb and blind, is it a metaphor for, which is how I wrote it, a metaphor for our spiritual ignorance and isolation, or is it actually a metaphor for how you feel when you're a teenager? And I think that maybe it's the latter, is what made Tommy successful. That even if people weren't interested in spirituality or Maya Barber or Sufism or where LSD or drugs or extraordinary, you know, extrasensory experiences were going to take you, even if they weren't interested in that, they knew what the basic story was about. Did you ever see the faces of the children? They get so excited.
Up next, Tommy encounters Cousin Kevin and the Acid Queen when part one of our visit in the studio with Pete Townsend of The Who continues. Welcome back to part one of our two-part visit in the studio with Pete Townsend for the making of Tommy. I'm Redbeard. The Who were one of the first rock bands to acknowledge the subject of child abuse in a pop song, one of their early songs, I'm a Boy. Compared to today, that was one subject that didn't get discussed too openly back in the 60s. In Tommy, The Who deal with the topic again, with perverted Uncle Ernie and sadistic Cousin Kevin.
You know, a lot of people have said to me, oh, well, you know, the interesting thing about Tommy is, of course, now that it's all, you know, it's discussed openly and everything now. You know, I think it was then. It just wasn't kind of... What hadn't happened then is I don't think that victims had come forward ready to tell their stories. But I think we all knew that it happened. You know, we'd all experienced it. You know, we actually, you know, we knew what it was. We knew that the shades of things that had happened to us as individuals must have had more extreme manifestations with other people, you know. And a few things that happened to me when I was young, I used to think, well, you know, if that hadn't have stopped where it stopped, where would it have led to? You know, and I think everybody kind of has been down that pathway. So I grew up with that stuff. You know, I think now it's just that it gets on the TV. Cousin Kevin's actually about bullying. It's meant to be about the insensitivity of the bully and how we all bully, you know. And we bully because it's the style in which we're expected to grow up. We're expected to be bullies. It's cool to be a bully, you know. Still, you know, society tells us to be bullies in business and in relationships and, you know, feminism, you know, post-feminism is about anything. It's about trying to get over the fact that early feminism was about, you know, we can be bullies too. You know, we don't actually have to be secretive and scheming to get control of the family. We can just demand control. Certainly, you know, in to avoid controversy, and you know, in the male world, bullying is a function of life, and it's the way that you get things done, and it's horrible and abhorrent, but that's the fact, and it starts when you're a kid.
I think we've all known a cousin Kevin at some point in our lives, and certainly Tommy's experience with him wasn't a pleasant one. But then Tommy came upon the Acid Queen. Townsend chose the character to be a gypsy. I asked Pete what he knew about gypsies at that time.
Well, my family has got some gypsy blood. My mother's mother was born of a gypsy girl who her dad had left his wife with two children to pursue this young gypsy girl, and that is part of the strain of my family. And my grandmother used to, you know, do magic stuff. She used to put curses on people and they would die, you know. And my mother has definitely got really, you know, deep, you know. And I'm not just doing this to kind of you know, romanticize my family. The other thing really, I think, is that wandering thing. I wanted to kind of create this idea that the Acid Queen was a wanderer, like a singer, or a, you know, rather than a whore, you know, somebody who, there was a craft, like a minstrel or something, some kind of black art.
If your child ain't all he should be now, this girl can put him right. I'll show him what I'm guaranteed to tear your soul apart.
Hey, before we start, who can forget Tina Turner recreating the role of the Acid Queen in the film version of Tommy? You know, for all of the discussion that has taken place in regard to the story of Tommy, it's interesting to note that Townsend wrote this rock opera first and foremost with the intention of The Who playing it live on stage.
I think that in a sense, everything that I did always had, if it was written for The Who, it was obviously going to be a stage piece. We were a performing band. You know, we weren't a studio band like the Beatles had become. You know, and so that was the distinction that I would make to myself, is that we can't do a Sergeant Pepper type thing. We can't do a Pet Sounds type thing. We can't do a studio masterpiece. We have to do something that we can play. That's why Tommy is so simple. That's why it's so unorchestrated, so unscrewed around with in the studio. We had wonderful people to work with, and lots of technology available by the time we were in the studio. And you know, and I was a killer technician. You know, I'd actually been I've had my own recording studio since I was 17 years old. I know that stuff. We kept it really simple because we wanted to play it. So in a sense, although it was recorded and composed for the stage. It had to work live.
After succeeding as a concept, an album, a vehicle for The Who to play on stage, and a film, Tommy has made his way to the Broadway stage with Townsend in a consultory music supervision role. I asked Pete Townsend what it is about Tommy that keeps the performance a viable property 25 years later.
Well, I think it's partly because of the story. I think it's partly because it has a story. But, you know, I think also because the music has the ability to last. You know, it's some of my best work. And it has a kind of, if it's not truly thematic, the writing musically, it certainly has a quality that is of its time. It demands attention because of, you know, I think the other thing is with, you know, again, I don't want, you know, to take the opportunity in interviews to sort of, you know, I end up listening to these things back and thinking, Jesus Christ, but you sound so smug. You know, I do think that I've been very smart about Tommy, about the way, you know, Kit Lambert and my lawyer registered a grand right for Tommy, which means that nobody can perform it or any part of it without my express permission, not even a school or a brass band. You can't play it on the street without my permission. What it's enabled me to do is to make sure that for 25 years, apart from the film and odd other moments, when you want Tommy, you go to MCA, and there it is, the original, unadulterated idea, warts and all. And I think that's why it survived to some extent. I think it's also survived because The Who have always made it a centrepiece of their live performance.
Fantastic work from all of them, including Keith Moon on drums. And that's part one of our two-part tribute to The Who's Tommy in the studio with our guest, Pete Townsend. I'm Redbeard. We'll be back with a final word right after this.
In the studio was sponsored by AT&T and by Trident Sugarless Gum.
AT&T, the right choice, wants you to choose a legendary rock album that you'd like to have featured on an upcoming edition of In the Studio. Send your choice on a postcard with your name, address, and phone number to In the Studio, Post Office Box 10655, Burbank, California 91510. Winners chosen in a random drawing will receive a 10 compact disc collection, The Legends of Rock, courtesy of AT&T, the right choice. I'm Redbeard. Thanks to Pete Townsend. Join us both in the studio for part two of The Who's Tommy next week at this same time. Special thanks to Bill Kirbishley and Ann Weldon. Also to Randy Miller, Gina Iorillo, and David Fleischman of MCA Records. In the Studio is a Bullet production by yours truly, Redbeard, and Mark Felsoff. Written by Mark Felsoff. Production assistance, editing, and digital mastering by Rick R.J. Lane. With transcription by Jane Carpenter. The executive producer of In the Studio is Stephen R. Smith. This week in the studio, the story of the world's first and most famous rock opera.
Rock and roll is about the moment that you become alone, the moment when you grow up, the moment when you leave home, or the moment when you... The reference I always give now, currently, is that East of Eden moment where Jimmy Dean is facing his dad across the room and he's about to leave and it's all in his face. He can't speak. It's like a great kind of My Generation stuttering moment. He can't say what he wants to say. But interestingly enough, neither can his father. His father can spill out invective, call his son a creep, tell him he's got to get a job, you know. And then there's this thing with the mother, you know, who wants everything to be right. That moment is what rock and roll is about. Whether you stay or whether you go, you are from that moment alone. You will never ever not be alone again, and that's what rock and roll is about. Hi, this is Pete Townsend in the studio for the making of The Who's Tommy Part 1. I think that in a sense, everything that I did always had... If it was written for The Who, it was obviously going to be a stage piece. We were a performing band. What? You know, we weren't a studio band like the Beatles had become. You know, and so that was the distinction that I would make to myself, is that we can't do a Sgt. Pepper type thing. We can't do a Pet Sounds type thing. We can't do a studio masterpiece. We have to do something that we can play. That's why Tommy is so simple. That's why it's so unorchestrated, so unscrewed around with in the studio. We had, you know, we had wonderful people to work with and lots of technology available by the time we were in the studio. And, you know, and I was a killer technician. You know, I'd actually been you know, I've had my own recording studio since I was 17 years old. I know that stuff. We kept it really simple because we wanted to play it. So in a sense, although it was recorded, it was recorded and composed for the stage. It had to work live.
Every child ain't all he should be now. This girl can put him right. I'll show him.
In the Studio is sponsored by AT&T and by Trident.
Doc, you did some time to get Jeff a left hand. Didn't like the way your hand was in the morning.
Excuse me, is this thing on?
Whoa. Excuse me.
You're welcome.
Guitar up.
One,
turn
two,
that guitar
three.
Up.
Hi, and welcome to In the Studio. I'm Redbeard, bringing you the stories behind the greatest rock and roll albums in history. Today, it's part two of In the Studio's tribute to the album that started as a rock opera, then became a film, and now a Broadway production.
I'm free.
It really was a last gasp. I mean, I believe that it would be a good work, and I think that it was then, you know, when I heard myself saying that, that I realised that the main problem was going to be that we were going to be labelled forever as being pretentious. And once I was ready to take that on board, I thought, well, that's it, right, for the rest of my life, I will be pretentious. You know, I think that I will be a pretender. I will be a pretender to grander ideas. I will always want more from this great music and for this great audience than we're currently getting. That what we're getting now isn't enough.
Listening to you, I get the music, gazing at you.
Hi, this is Pete Townsend in the studio for the making of The Who's Tommy Part 2.
If there was one song that could be considered the main attraction or the focal point of Tommy the Rock Opera, it would have to be Pinball Wizard, which is where we begin Part 2 of In the Studio's tribute to Tommy. Released as a single prior to the full album in 1969, Pinball Wizard became a huge hit for The Who and a staple in their live show for years to follow. The song was also the turning point for the story of Tommy. It's during Pinball Wizard that we first begin to see Tommy in a different light. Pinball Wizard also caused quite a controversy for The Who when it was initially released in their native England. More on that in just a bit. Ironically, it was one of the last songs written for Tommy. Here's Pete Townsend.
It was a fairly spontaneous piece, which I think is probably why it's so good. It also came towards the end of the album. We delivered the album for review, preview, to a friend of ours called Nick Cohen, who was a writer for the Manchester Guardian. He's very young. I think he was only about 20 years old. He was the youngest pop writer in England at the time, working for a conventional newspaper. And he hadn't really liked Tommy, and I was very disappointed. I expected him to like it, and he said it's okay, you know. And we went out, and we were, you know, shooting pinball in some arcade somewhere. And I said to him, you know, if Tommy was a pinball player, would you be more receptive to the idea? And he turned around to me and he said, yeah. So I went home and I wrote the song. And then I replayed him the piece with all of the references to Tommy, rather than just being a spiritual leader, being a pinball player. And so the pinball became a metaphor for the life of a rock star, or even the life of a guru. And Nick said, it's great, it works. He said, it's not just great because you've done this for me, you know, and I will give it a good review. He said, what it's actually done is it's add some colour and some real pop to this otherwise really quite boring idea about kind of the spiritual life, you know. He actually found the idea quite kind of depressing, and he felt that when I introduced pinball, and I wrote the song in an hour or 2 hours. I went back and sort of knocked it out and did a two-track demo, acoustic guitar with an electric guitar overdub. Took it to the studio and we recorded it, and very, very simple song to do.
Another reason for Pinball's success was the music. It's a majestic piece that combines Townsend's power electric guitar chords with his now signature acoustic guitar strumming. I asked Pete Townsend if his use of acoustic guitar throughout Tommy was sheer genius or pure necessity.
No, I think genius. I think if there's anything that I can claim in my life as genius, it's that way I play on that song. I think it was a discovery of a technique which is actually very, very complex. It's much more complex than it readily appears. It's about the way that you hold the pick. The pick has to float in midair. It mustn't be held. It mustn't be held stiffly. It has to be float between the fingers so that the strokes on the guitar are completely feather-light. And, of course, the danger is that while the pick is floating, you drop it. So the technique is to develop a technique where the pick is floating gently between the fingers, but you never drop it. And once you can actually master that, you can do anything on the acoustic guitar. You can do 64th strokes, whatever you want to do. Almost as though you were just, you know, letting your finger go into kind of overload. You know, it's the only thing that I ever was really, really vain about as a musician was that. I always used to think, well, you know, Steve Stills might be cool, but he can never do that. Nobody can ever do that. Jimi Hendrix might be okay, but what a wanky acoustic player he is, you know. You know, nobody can do that.
Great song, but it had controversy. Here's Pete Townsend on the controversy surrounding the song Pinball Wizard.
The BBC banned Pinball Wizard briefly. But Pinball Wizard was released before the album, and out of context it seemed like, you know, a pop band singing about a deaf, dumb and blind kid. It seemed gratuitous. But once the BBC got the album and saw the context of the piece, then they immediately unbanned it. By which time, of course, it was number 4 in the charts. But and there were a few red faces, you know. I mean, a couple of guys that I know on radio, I think, regretted, you know, having spoken so quickly and so loudly. But, you know, it wasn't their fault. It did seem a bit crass, you know.
Although the brief ban by the BBC didn't affect the public's response to Pinball Wizard, I asked Townsend how the press reacted to the album as a whole when it was released shortly thereafter.
Because of the way that we handled it, because we'd had the salutary lesson of Pinball Wizard being attacked for being sick, what we did is we pandered absolutely to the main spice of journalist life. We hired a club and we gave them free booze and we entertained them. And so the reviews were ecstatic, generally. There were a few exceptions. There were people that found it pretentious, that people that found the whole thing distasteful. But it was all spectacular news, whatever it was. It was well received in the manner that you want something to be well received. I mean, some people hated it and some people loved it, but everybody spoke very loudly about it. And the stunning thing about it was, I mean, what I do remember prior to the press show at Ronnie Scott's was Keith Moon and me driving back from Ealing, where we'd actually spent 2 days rehearsing the show. You know, in fact, I say 2 days, we weren't all that keen on rehearsal. I think it was 1 day, running the show down. And we went to a pub in Ealing and propped up the bar for half an hour. And Keith was a difficult guy in those days. You know, it was very difficult to ever know, you know, when he was being sincere or when he was, you know, winding you up or whatever. And he just looked at me and he just said, you know, Pete, he said, I'm so proud of the fact that we can play that thing. And I said to him, yeah, I am too. And he said, and what makes me really proud is that it was so easy. It was so easy. He said, I was, you know, because it's taken 3 months to record, he said, I just thought it was going to be a nightmare. He said, I'm so proud of myself that I can remember it all and that we can do it. And And I said, yeah, I said, I feel exactly that way. And then he said, you know, this is going to be extraordinary to play live. It's going to change our life. And I said, yeah, I think you're right. Anyway, we went off, and I don't think we ever got a full feeling of the measure of how true that was until we started to tour the States with it, where you were given a two-hour slot if you wanted it, whereas in the UK you were still trying, they were still trying to get you off the stage. You know, they were literally, it would be that they would be pulling the curtain down if you played for more than 35 minutes, you know. It's kind of...
That's Go to the Mirror Boy, featuring a conversation between Tommy, his father, and the doctor. Ironically, it was a conversation that Pete Townshend had back in 1968 with Rolling Stone magazine, where, for the first time, Townshend fully explained this vision he had for a rock opera called Tommy.
When I actually really put the whole thing together in my own mind was in a conversation, a long, long, long conversation, after a Fillmore show in San Francisco with Jan Wenner. And we were just buddies at the time, you know, and Rolling Stone was a kind of San Francisco broadsheet. We went to hang out over there and do this interview for his magazine. And I just started to tell the story. And about halfway through, I started to really freak. And I said to him, am I making sense? And he said, you're making a lot of sense. So I carried on. And what he actually did was he printed the whole article, the whole conversation. It was a 2 or 3 hour conversation. He printed it absolutely verbatim. And so I had a record of this moment, you know, which was me and him and some other people that I respected sitting around talking about this album that we were about to make. We hadn't even really started recording it. And that became my blueprint. And so what I actually had was a book, the book for Tommy, is that Rolling Stone article.
Tommy, can you hear me?
The frustration of Tommy's mother with Tommy, Can You Hear Me? And Smash the Mirror. I'm Redbeard, and you're in the studio with Pete Townshend for part two of our tribute to The Who's Tommy. The story continues right after this. Welcome back to part two of our visit with Pete Townshend in the studio for The Who's rock opera Tommy. I'm Redbeard, and as I mentioned last week, The Who were pretty much known for being a singles band up until Tommy. So it must have been quite an interesting meeting when Townshend first presented this ambitious idea to Keith Moon, John Entwistle, and Roger Daltrey of The Who.
I can't remember the early discussions. All I can remember is a general feeling of being amazed at how supportive everybody in the band was. Because, you know, I think I'd made a few dumb mistakes just prior to Tommy. And was getting a bit silly. And I think that it might have appeared that this was another one of those silly things, like, you know, songs about dog racing or whatever. But I think they really recognised that it was a good idea. And it wasn't a completely formed idea, and they were very, very helpful in forming it. John wrote two great songs, as you know, Cousin Kevin and Uncle Ernie. Keith helped me with the holiday camp idea. Roger never wrote anything actually for the piece, but certainly was very, very hard working and evident and supportive of the idea.
I overwhelm as I approach you, make your lungs grow breath inside.
Through the smashing of the mirror and the song Sensation, Tommy has been miraculously cured in the story. It's no surprise that the spiritual side of Pete Townshend comes to the surface in the story of Tommy. To understand where Townshend was coming from, you have to examine the things that were inspiring him during the writing period of Tommy. Townshend was a big follower of Meyer Baba, the same Baba in Baba O'Reilly on Who's Next. And Pete was a big believer in mysticism.
Where a lot of the joy of the discovery of mysticism for me came from was Sufi writing, particularly the musician Inayat Khan, who was a world-class international musician who actually became a spiritual master and wrote lots of books about music and art as well as, you know, the spiritual life. And I found his writing very evocative. It was a bit like kind of reading about quantum mechanics or you know, the Big Bang theory or the free lunch theory or something. Actually, a lot of the early writing were almost kind of like, you know, reading about science and physics. And also kind of infused with this feeling that maybe music was mystical, magical, which is what, you know, when you're a musician, you know, people keep telling you how talented you are, and what you want to say to them is, hold on, you know, this isn't talent, this is magic.
Extra, extra, read all about it, the pinball wizard and the miracle cure. Extra, extra, read all about it, extra.
We now come to the story of Sally Simpson, a girl overwhelmed by her love, or call it infatuation, with Tommy, who's now reached the popularity status equal of that to a big-name rock and roll star. And poor old Sally Simpson will do just about anything to meet her idol.
The problem with celebrity is that it's not manufactured by the artist at all. Some guy was in a bar, one of the guys from the crew, Tommy Crew. He said that he had a pal who was an extra and had driven Madonna around on a documentary shoot. And they went round the block to reshoot her arriving at some club or something. And so it was just him and her in the car. And they came to some traffic lights, and some girls on a corner noticed her. And she kind of ducked down. And he said, you know, you don't need to duck down. They're not going to hurt you. Just wave at them. And she said to him, do you really think I should? In a way, that kind of says it all. It just says it all. You know, it's like, you know, you are, as an artist, as a star, you belong to, you are charged by your audience. They are the ones that you ultimately, you know, you want to know whether they want you, those kids, to act like an arsehole, to ignore them, or to wave at them. And you've got to try and divine that. Because if you wave at them, you might actually be reducing yourself in their eyes. You know, depends how they see you. You know, so sometimes when people say, you know, I met Jack Nicholson on a plane the other day, and he's a really nice guy. And you think, well, okay, Jack, that's one fan you've lost. now you're his best buddy, you know. He'll never go and see you in a movie again. You know, it's difficult. It's difficult. And I think that what Sally Simpson actually addresses is the difficulty that I was having with that at the time. And I think that I have less difficulty with it today.
Outside the house, Mr. Simpson announced that Sally couldn't go to the meeting. He went on cleaning his blue Rolls Royce and she ran inside a weeping.
The story of Sally Simpson from Tommy. Coming up next, the conclusion to Tommy the Rock Opera, plus more insight from the writer and creator, Pete Townsend. I'm Redbeard, in the studio, for The Who's Tommy, Part 2.
Hi, this is Pete Townsend in the studio for the making of The Who's Tommy Part 2.
And I'm Redbeard. In speaking with Pete Townsend about this wonderful piece of music, this rock opera called Tommy, you get the sense that the most difficult challenge wasn't the songwriting or the recording or the performance, but rather Pete Townsend convincing himself that he would survive artistically whether Tommy succeeded or failed. Townsend did a lot of soul searching before he finally realized that he just had to make this album, Tommy.
It really was a last gasp. I mean, I believe that it would be a good work. And I think that it was then, you know, when I heard myself saying that, that I realized that the main problem was going to be that we were going to be labeled forever as being pretentious. And once I was ready to take that on board, I thought, well, that's it, right, for the rest of my life, I will be pretentious. You know, I think that I will be a pretender. I will be a pretender to grander ideas. I will always want more from this great music and for this great audience than we're currently getting. That what we're getting now isn't enough. I didn't think Pink Floyd were good enough. I thought that they were interesting, but I didn't think that they were enough. I didn't think the Soft Machine were enough. I didn't think Arthur Brown was enough. I didn't actually think Jimi Hendrix was enough. It was masterful, it was brilliant, and he was a great, great genius, but it wasn't going to do any... It wasn't... You know, he was still just an island. It wasn't going to change everything else. You know, and what Jimmy has done, really, is I suppose he's just upped the ante on the style of guitar... quality of guitar playing that's been required in rock ever since. But it hasn't changed the form. It didn't change the form. And I think, interestingly enough, you know, Tommy didn't change the form. There hasn't been, you know, a rash of rock operas since. So at that particular time, I think Jimmy was one of the reasons that, you know, I was so desperate. There was no way in hell I was ever going to be... I knew I could never play like Eric, but at least I had my stunts. You know, at least I had my guitar style and my, you know, my arm swinging and my guitar smashing and, you know, my Union Jack jacket or whatever I was into. Suddenly that all looked like so much dust. You know, like so much magic dust, so much kind of, like so many kind of sequins falling off a busker's jacket, you know. And I just felt like, my God, I've got to be honest now. What am I? I'm a writer. I'm an ideas man. I'm a simple soul. Address that. Do it. If people think it's shit, fine. You know, at least it's you. And so Tommy was a very, very kind of honest, direct piece of work. Came out of an adversity of, you know, which was partly financial but also partly emotional. You know, I could see psychedelics had come along and changed the audience perception. Although it was only kind of brief. You know, when we came to America, it seemed almost like a revolution. But when we were exposed to it in America, we were exposed to it at the Monterey Pop Festival, you know, which was, you know, one of the great early psychedelic events where maybe half or a third of the people in the audience had taken some kind of hallucinogenic drug, even if it was just, you know, lots of marijuana.
Another rock radio staple from the rock opera Tommy, that's called I'm Free. Over the years, Townsend has worn many different hats when it comes to Tommy, with the Broadway production in full gear and with 11 Tony nominations. I asked Pete Townsend what his role is now.
I'm the co-book writer. That's what I did. I wrote the book with Des McAnuff. And the book in music theatre is like the film script in a film. It's a, you know, 100-page document with directions, dialogue, scene descriptions, a certain rhythmic pace inferred, you know, the show divided into acts, the lyrics. And that becomes the blueprint for the production and makes, obviously, and infers and demands certain technical requirements of the show. I've done much, much more on the show than I ever thought I would. But I'm also there, you know, the cast continually tell me that, you know, that I'm also there as something, as a kind of a presence.
Good morning, campers. I'm your uncle Ernie, and I welcome you to Tommy's
Holiday. From Tommy's Holiday Camp to the stage at Woodstock.
Welcome.
There have been many memorable performances of Tommy, some in which The Who played Tommy from the beginning to end, and others where they highlighted some of the best songs from the opera. The Who set at Woodstock featured quite a few songs from Tommy, and also featured The Who in their prime as a live band. Pete Townsend has this recollection from that middle-of-the-night performance in upstate New York.
When we started listening to You, I Get the Music, it was dark. And I just kept playing it until the sun came up. I think we played it for 25 minutes, listening to You, I Get the Music. And the audience was starting to kind of get a bit fed up with it, I think. And then suddenly the sun broke over the hill. I was kind of praying for it. And they just went berserk. The sun just went boing, tsh, you know. And then we played it for another 20 minutes. I remember John Entwistle being very pissed off that I'd kept it going for so long.
Welcome to the camp. I guess you all know why we're here. My name is Tom at the Mountain. I get excited at your beam.
From you, I get opinions. From you, I get the story. Thank you, Pete Townsend, for giving us the story in the studio for the Who's Tommy Part 2. I'm Redbeard. We'll be back for a final word in just a moment.
In the Studio was sponsored by AT&T and by Bacardi Breezers. AT&T, the right choice, wants you to choose a legendary rock album that you'd like to have featured on an upcoming edition of In the Studio. Send your choice on a postcard with your name, address, and phone number to In the Studio, P.O. Box 10655, Burbank, California, 91510. Winners chosen in a random drawing will receive a 10-compact disc collection, The Legends of Rock, courtesy of AT&T, the right choice.
I'm Redbeard. My thanks to Pete Townsend for joining us in the studio for our two-part tribute to the Who's rock opera, Tommy. And see it on Broadway while you can. Special thanks to Bill Kirbishley and Ann Weldon. And also to Randy Miller, Gina Irillo, and David Fleischman of MCA Records. In the Studio is a Bullet production produced by yours truly, Redbeard, and by Mark Felsa. Today's show was written by Mark Felsa. Production assistance, editing, and digital mastering by Rick R.J. Lane. Transcription by Jane Carpenter. The executive producer of In the Studio is Stephen R. Smith.
Was a last gasp. I mean, I believe that it would be a good work, and I think that it was then, you know, when I heard myself saying that, that I realised that the main problem was going to be that we were going to be labelled forever as being pretentious. And once I was ready to take that on board, I thought, well, that's it, right, for the rest of my life I will be pretentious. You know, I think that I will be a pretender. I will be a pretender to grander ideas. I will always want more from this great music and for this great audience than we're currently getting. That what we're getting now isn't enough.
Listening to you, I get the music. Gazing at you, I get the heat.
Hi, this is Pete Townsend in the studio for the making of The Who's Tommy Part 2. It was a fairly spontaneous piece, which I think is probably why it's so good. It also came towards the end of the album. We delivered the album for review, preview, to a friend of ours called Nick Cohen, who was a writer for the Manchester Guardian. He's very young. I think he was only about 20 years old. He was the youngest pop writer in England at the time, working for a conventional newspaper. And he hadn't really liked Tommy, and I was very disappointed. I expected him to like it, and he said it's okay, you know. And we went out, and we were, you know, shooting pinball in some arcade somewhere. And I said to him, you know, if Tommy was a pinball player, would you be more receptive to the idea? And he turned around to me, and he said, yeah. So I went home, and I wrote the song. And then I replayed him the piece with all of the references to Tommy, rather than just being a spiritual leader, being a pinball player. And so the pinball became a metaphor for the life of a rock star or even the life of a guru. And Nick said, it's great, it works. He said, it's not just great because you've done this for me, you know, and I will give it a good review. He said, what it's actually done is it's added some colour and some real pop to this otherwise really quite boring idea about kind of the spiritual life, you know. He actually found the idea quite kind of depressing, and he felt that when I introduced pinball, and I wrote the song in an hour or 2 hours, I went back and sort of knocked it out and did a two-track demo, acoustic guitar with an electric guitar overdub, took it to the studio and we recorded it, and very, very simple song to do.